Okay. Thank you to the organizers for inviting me to talk about helium. This is a fun pet project right now for me and my collaborators. Let's see. There we go. So my day job is on LuxNLZ, which you just heard about, but I will be talking about the possibility of using our lightest noble gas, helium, to probe very light dark matter particles. So in particular, basically going to the regime that Reuven was talking about, sort of sub-GeV. And this is work, so Scott Hertel was a postdoc in my group. He's now a faculty at UMass Amherst, and these are some students and a postdoc at UC Berkeley. Actually, Vetri just a couple days ago got this Graduate Instrumentation Research Award for future work on this idea, so that's exciting. Okay, that's not working. So, as Reuven talked about, and others, you know, we have this sort of, and this is a spin-independent cross-section versus dark matter mass, and we have these, you know, heavier, especially noble liquid targets sort of coming down and fitting snugly in time into this neutrino floor space here. And so it's useful to sort of think about the field as sort of this combination of high mass searches here and possibly going down to low masses out here and to the left. Now, of course, these are all moving forward very quickly, and in some sense we're becoming a victim of our own success in that so far we haven't seen the dark matter. Pretty soon, maybe 15 years or so, we're going to be starting to hit atmospheric neutrino background here. And then, you know, if we see dark matter, that's fantastic. If we don't, I would predict that despite Harry's comments, no amount of conning is going to get us pushing below the neutrino floor. And, you know, we have to, you know, of course, maybe other signatures like EFT or inelastic dark matter might give us enough motivation to push into here. And in some cases, this is compatible with neutrinoless double beta decay searches, which are also exciting. But clearly, if we don't see something here, our road is going to become much tougher to motivate experiments at the, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to billion dollar cost scale.
15 years, is that, to get there? 15?
My rough guess to get here, yeah. It's moving very quickly, and there's no, you know, we're going down on this exponential, and we're going to hit the neutrino floor in 15 years, probably. So, of course, there are many well-motivated dark matter models in this space, especially up at around the TeV scale, and we will test those. If we are lucky, we'll see dark matter there. But so I'm going to be talking more about going to a lighter target and lower threshold where there is it's very well-motivated theoretically, and there's lots of open parameter space. So in this regime, looking for nuclear recoils, so again, a spin-independent cross-section, one of the best approaches right now is using crystals and transition edge sensor readout. This is the CREST experiment. And basically, the calcium tungstenate crystals and a calorimeter-based readout. And you saw some of these plots earlier, but they're going down to the, in this case, 200 MeV scale and up higher, sort of at the 100 MeV scale down in mass. Okay, so starting to push into this cross-section space. Here's an example of their more recent limit. So this is actually an experiment, sort of a gram or so of sapphire with TS readout at the surface, pushing into new parameter space. A very small, cheap experiment testing plausible dark matter models. So what I'll be talking about is sort of an alternative approach to look for these nuclear recoils using a light target. And some of the arguments for helium are here. Basically, it's obviously a light target, so the kinematics are very good for scattering with a light dark matter particle in comparison to heavier targets. So basically, if you think about a 1 GeV dark matter particle, you might get recoil spectra like this for these targets, and helium pushes out. Limiting quantity in these experiments is energy threshold. And so for a given energy threshold here, you can see that you'll get more signal in a helium detector for these low masses. The key thing is that the helium has many signal channels. So in the xenon or liquid argon, you hear about light and charge. In helium, you can supplement this with actually a few more signals. There are actually these triplet excimers, which move ballistically through the helium. They're an electronic excitation. There's also heat, and there are multiple kinds of heat, quasi-particle excitations in the helium. So go by the names of phonons and rotons. And we can add these signal channels when we work with helium, because helium is liquid all the way down to absolute zero. So this allows us to use transition edge sensor readout, like they do in CREST or CDMS. And this technology is advancing still very quickly. And while phototubes, say in liquid xenon that we use, or liquid argon, are limited in photon detection by the quantum efficiency, typically around 30%, when you tile your detector with TES, you basically have 100% light collection, just limited by your solid angle. And that can allow you to detect the scintillation photons as well as these triplet excimers that move ballistically through the helium. And so we can also take advantage of the extremely low vapor pressure of superfluid helium at low temperatures. It's essentially liquid and then vacuum above it. Okay, and this allows us to use quantum evaporation-based heat signal detection, which I'll discuss in more detail. Another interesting fact is that you can expect helium to have a lot of efficient light production and charge production, which turns into light production upon recombination, compared to heavier targets. Basically, if you have a lighter nucleus ripping through your liquid, it's more efficient for exciting electrons than if it's a heavier target trying to excite electrons. In the parlance of the field, it should have a more forgiving Lindhardt factor. Nuclear recoil signal should be quenched less than in the heavier noble liquids. So we're talking about helium-4. We're not talking about helium-3, which should definitely break the bank very quickly. This is just helium-4, and the target cost is negligible as part of the experiment. The relatively low backgrounds for neutrino nucleus scattering, only two neutrons here, and those cross-sections will just go as n squared. Gamma nucleus scattering is also suppressed because of the low Z. Interestingly, because it's a superfluid, if you have vibrations on the walls, those are not transferred efficiently into the bulk. And so there's actually a relatively low vibration sensitivity in the target itself compared to, say, if you had a solid target. The ionization gap is large, which means that you have, for light or charge, fewer quanta per keV energy deposition than in superconductors or semiconductors. On the other hand, this means there's no electron recoil background below 16 eV. There's no way to create an electronic excitation below those energies. And the helium is extremely easy to purify. It's the most noble of the noble gases. It's very low, very easily purified using cold traps, charcoal, and getters. And actually, whatever is left in the liquid will literally fall out by gravity out of the detector. So we think that the helium itself should not be an important background or anything in the helium. So here's a big, brief picture of the concept. So as I mentioned, you have your bath of superfluid. You have calorimetry readout surrounding the target as best as possible. And then there's vacuum up here, and then another transition edge sensor array here in the vacuum. Okay, so if you have an event, then you can get photons produced. Those are detected by the TES detectors. If there are triplet excimers produced, those will also move ballistically in millisecond time scale, quench on the walls, and be detected. And then the phonons and the rotons, these quasi-particles, will actually bounce around in the cell, and if they hit the surface of the liquid, can liberate a helium atom through quantum evaporation. The reflectivity is expected to be very high. There's poor impedance matching for that wave, that phonon, between the liquid and the walls because of the low density of the superfluid helium. And I'll show you some numbers on the reflectivity in the coming slides, but expect it to be very high. So you can think about this like if you're used to using a crystal detector, sodium iodide or something, and you wrap it with Tyvek, something reflective, and you put a PMT with its photocathode, you know, you can think about, wrapping that with something very reflective and efficiently collecting the scintillation light. You can kind of think of it that way in terms of the heat particles, quasi-particles, rattling around in the detector and hitting the vacuum liquid interface to produce single quanta of helium atoms as your detected signal, sort of analogous to the photoelectrons from a PMT. So again, multiple signal channels. We've moved to preferring a model where there's no drift field. We could think about detecting single electrons in this way, similar to what's done in CDMS, and getting, you know, tens of kilovolts of signal for every electron. But our preference is to move into a regime there is no electric field to keep dark counts down. And we think just using these signals, the scintillation, the triplet excimers, and the heat should suffice. Now, I'll show you the discrimination between particles types, and between actual particle events and dark current should be possible using the ratios of these different signal channels. Okay, so if you have an event, this is much like you get in the other noble liquids, you get some excitation, you can excite helium atoms, those interact with other helium atoms in the liquid to form helium excimers. You also get ionization. In helium, the recombination is very, very efficient. So the electrons don't get very far from their host ion. Those recombine, and you get these helium excimers produced very efficiently, produce prompt ultraviolet photons. It's a very high energy, 16 eV, 80 nanometer photons, little bombs when they hit your transition edge sensor. There are also these long-lived triplet molecules, similar energy scale. There's also IR photons. And these are all detectable with the same TES readout. Okay, so it sounds a bit exotic, but it's not terribly exotic to use superfluid helium as a detector. Here's a project that I worked on as a graduate student using superfluid helium 4 to capture, trap, and detect neutrons. So we basically had a cold neutron beam we sent into a bath of superfluid helium. Some fraction of those would scatter and be captured in a magnetic trap here that I built. And we would watch those neutrons decay one at a time. From the scintillation in the liquid helium, we would count the electrons decaying, neutrons decaying in the trap, and read out the signal with the wavelength shifter and light guides. So this technology is now being used quite a bit in searches for the neutron electric dipole moment. Here's one example. There's a project in the US. The main one is being built at the Spallation Neutron Source in Tennessee to search for the neutron EDM, which in many ways is sort of a similar flavor to these dark matter searches, searching very, very, measuring zero more and more accurately. More analogous to what I'm talking about here is an idea that was proposed to measure the pp solar neutrino flux to 1%. This is called HERON. A lot of work done in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, basically measuring the pp flux accurately could have helped narrow down the parameter space for neutrinos. If the smaller mixing angle solution had been correct, this would have been especially useful. Basically, the sales went out of this project, and other PP neutrino experiments, like CLEAN, after the solar neutrino problem was solved, and the large mixing angle solution was found by Kamlin and Snow and others. But there is work, a fair amount of work done, especially at Brown University, on this technology. So this would have been a 5.6 meter diameter for a swimming pool of superfluid helium, with calorimeter arrays on top and detecting rotons and photons this way. This is the mass that you would need to measure the PP neutrino flux. They considered it for dark matter detection as well, but back in this time scale, light dark matter was theoretically excluded. Everyone said, you need a big nucleus to look for dark matter. Using a small target doesn't make any sense. And so they never focused on this technology for low mass dark matter. So the fashions of the day basically didn't push this for dark matter detection. These days, low mass dark matter is all the rage. But I wanted to point out that the concept was demonstrated, the basic concept of using liquid helium and quantum evaporation to detect both scintillation light and helium atom evaporation. Here we are at sort of hundreds of keV scale energies where they were demonstrating this. But so what we're talking about here is going to much smaller detectors, at least to start, but also much lower energy thresholds. The simple version of it, if you didn't try to collect the heat, would be to just detect scintillation photons and also the triplet excimers. We did a quick experiment in my group to basically detect both the scintillation light and the triplet excimers using TES readout, just a not heavy geometric coverage, but enough to demonstrate that it could be done. Even though these detectors are immersed in the superfluid, they are still very efficient at this detection. The Kapitza resistance between the liquid helium and the detector itself is enough to allow you to read out the signal on a fast enough time scale. So that's a simple version. Here's just another picture of detecting these triplet excimers as well as the singlet scintillation photons. Where it gets even more complex is when you start adding in the phonon and roton channels. The physics gets even more rich. These are the phonons with the energy proportional to the momentum. Think out from here down to here, these are called rotons, okay? And if they're left of the minimum, they're called R minuses, and if they're right of the minimum, they're called R pluses. Interestingly, the R minuses have momentum opposite to their velocity, which makes those hard to cause quantum evaporation, but the phonons and the rotons can do that. The reflection on the walls has been measured on some surfaces to be extremely small, so there's a lot of work to be done. Like in super CDMS, they've done a lot of studying of phonons reflecting off the germanium crystals and keeping that efficiency high for signal collection. No doubt there would be similar studies needed for the liquid helium to maximize the signal. And the other key point is that this quantum evaporation is actually an amplification mechanism. So it takes 0.6 milliEV to evaporate a helium atom from the surface. So quasiparticles with less than that energy won't cause quantum evaporation. But then if they go through the vacuum and they bind on the surface of the calorimeter, you get tens of milliEV. So 10 milliEV for silicon. Some other more exotic surfaces, graphene, fluorinated graphene, can give you up to 40 milliEV. And so we're talking about an order of magnitude or more signal enhancement from this one-way energy transfer from the liquid to the calorimeter. We've also been doing a lot of simulations, and a key point is that the phonons and rotons can, if you like, change flavor when they reflect off a surface. So in here, you've got three different momenta at a given energy, and when they reflect off a surface, they can change type. They can go to different momentum. And so you can make a map. This is momentum, and whether you're starting with a phonon, an R minus or an R plus, how likely they are to change type if they reflect off a surface. And so we've built a Monte Carlo of this process to see how a detector would likely react. And we've also studied backgrounds, radioactive backgrounds, basically taking a lot of the assumptions from super CDMS about what shielding is plausible, and then just taking a zero background helium target, putting that in, gives us predictions for backgrounds. We also, based on a lot of the literature from atomic physics about if you hit a helium atom with another helium atom, how often do you get ionization or excitation, we're able to make predictions for ratios of signal types, triplets, the singlets, the phonons, and by just incorporating Poisson statistics on the electronic excitations, we're able to get predictions for discrimination power, which show that we should get discrimination power down to the tens of EV scale. So a couple orders of magnitude lower in energy than we see discrimination in liquid argon, liquid xenon, using this ratio of heat to light. So that looks very promising. And so we can then make predictions on the background level, given our Monte Carlo, on what kind of sensitivity we can get. Some of that will depend on the probability of absorption of these quasiparticles on surfaces, but we can make pretty conservative assumptions about possible absorption, even as high as 10 or even higher percent on per surface, to give us predictions for the signal size and the signal time scale from the quantum evaporation versus time. So it gives you an idea, you know, the signal is larger if there's less absorption, but it's slower. So there may perhaps a trade-off between speed of the detector and magnitude of the signal. You can even think below 20 eV, where there's no discrimination power based on light to heat, perhaps at lower energy, we can get some discrimination power based on the distribution of phonons and rotons. Outside the track, the phonons and rotons are extremely stable, and so can carry the information from the track to the detectors. And so you can think about possibly using timing information or spatial information on those heat particles to get your discrimination power. And so because a nuclear recoil will deposit its energy in a smaller volume, you can expect more photon-rotron-rotron-rotron interactions and a more thermal distribution of quasi-particles than for an electron recoil. So this, of course, will need lots of study. But here's some pictures. Again, here's the phonons, rotons. These are the velocities of those quasi-particles. These are the transmission, either through quantum evaporation in blue, which is high for the phonons and R pluses, and zero for the R minuses, or comparing to absorption in solid here in red dashed, to give you an idea. In our Monte Carlo, you can see in the detector, for the helium atoms that you detect that have high enough energy, you can get the phonons or the R minuses or the R pluses. You don't see the R minuses in the first bounce. This is the color just counting how many bounces those quasi-particles have made inside the detector. You can see the phonons and the R pluses after the first bounce. These need some number of bounces and flavor changes in order to see them, but by basically mixing up the signal types, you can extract that signal, albeit at later times with more bounces. And so, and here it's interesting, if you make different assumptions about the momentum distribution of the quasi-particles, here this would be a flat distribution, a linear distribution, or a quadratic distribution, you get different amounts of prompt signal versus delayed signal, and different spatial dependencies of those. So the hope is that if background or signal have different time dependencies, if you can calibrate your detector with neutrons or just with helium atoms shooting into the detector and understand the momentum distribution you should expect for your signal, we hope to be able to reject background by using this timing information. So we think this is a lot of rich information here. So here are some possible stages. G1, say a generation 1 liquid helium detector, using very conservative assumptions here, basically that lead to a 10 eV threshold. We think we can probe this parameter space here. And shaded here is the existing limits. You can see that a helium experiment could probe quite a lot of space, even in a first very small detector. So this is 1 kilogram year of exposure can explore this parameter space. And generation 2 with lower threshold, or even lower threshold, generation 3 with more R&D. And you know, we think this technology should also be very, very scalable. Much like the other noble liquids, so you can talk about hundreds of kilograms of target. Okay, I will stop talking. I've been told to stop talking, so I will.
I didn't make it.
So you can even think about grams of helium having interesting physics reach the surface like the nucleus experiment did. Okay, here's some pretty pictures of some R&D we're doing at Berkeley. Our dill fridge being set up and shielding. And I'll stop talking. Thanks.
Thank you, Dan. And now you can talk. Okay, so thank you, Dan. And questions?
Sorry, this is the joke. This is what I got.
Yeah, great talk. Thanks for good summary. You have a much wider dynamic range in terms of mass capability. And if you want to comment on that compared to
So you mean this wide range here?
Yeah.
It's basically, it's really, this is, I mean, to the left, this is all about energy threshold. So we're helped by, you know, all the development that's happening with TES readout, but of course also helped by the fact that the helium is low in mass. So, I mean, of course, the xenon and argon experiments, in a way, have much larger mass, those going up to infinity, effectively. Or 100 TeV if you're interested in thermal dark matter. But,
right, but if you were to compare what you could do with helium, which is relatively inexpensive, as you said, it's really perhaps a question of cryogenics to cool it sufficiently. I don't know if you've looked at comparison.
Oh, yeah. So we're the cryogenics is a relatively small part of the cost and difficulty, actually. I mean, these are Dilfridge-based experiments, but that technology is well established. And, you know, our target mass is, I mean, CREST, it's like, sorry, I'm thinking about CORE, which is a cubic meter of target at 10 mK. So you can certainly think about going up to the cubic meter scale in a similar way to CORE in the long term. Nice thing here is that even with, you know, grams of material or here, you know, 1 kilogram a year, you can explore interesting parameter space with discrimination power, I should add, which gives us a handle on backgrounds versus signal. So I would say discovery is possible here. Under,
more questions? Okay, well, if not, let's thank Dan again and all the speakers. So we close the session. And we reconvene at 2 p.m.